Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans.
$829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
Well, I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the One Heat Minute Productions Patreon, early Patreon, preliminarily exclusive Decade Project podcast. I am your host, Blake Howard. This is the show where we mark a line in the sand. This is the year 2024, and we look back to 10 years ago, which is 2014. So you may be listening to this on our Patreon, or you may be listening to this little later in the year of 2024, I get a cache of amazing people to come back and talk to me about their favorite film of 10 years ago. We're looking to see what resonated at the time, what maybe were the big splashes, what are the movies that are hanging around. And so today I'm really, really lucky to be talking to a dear friend of mine. He's a staff writer at the Next Best Picture. He's been on, I think, everyone, almost every kind of podcast we've done here at One Heat Minute Productions in some way, shape, or form. He's an exceptionally talented writer, a great film mind, an essential Twitter, I'm never calling it X, follow. And he's just done some amazing pieces that I can really highly recommend on two Nolan films, Tenet and Oppenheimer, for Bright Wall Dark Room. He's my dear friend, Brendan Hodges. Mate, welcome to the Decade Project.
So happy to be here, man. Thank you so much. That was way, way too kind. I'll try my best to live up to it.
Stop. So 10 years ago, what is the movie that we are covering on this 2024 Decade Project, Brendan Hodges?
We are discussing Richard Linklater's extremely unique and marvelous film, Boyhood.
You don't want the bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
We have a new student joining us today.
Hey, dude. Welcome to the suck.
Mom. Have you been partying?
A little bit.
Oh.
Be Mason, what do you want to do?
All right, you guys would have just heard a trailer pop in there. Richard Linklater's, as Brendan said, incredible film. I was going through, as we do on this show, through the selections of like the top critics from the time. writing about this film is, you know, Mark Kermode called it, you simply forget about the head scrambling logistics of this thing. Leonard Maltin said, like, he's that Linklater was an original thinker, but his latest work, Boyhood, is in a class by itself. You've got Wesley Morris says, to sit with this movie and witness the concentrated passage of time is to watch in a true moving way your life unspool before your eyes without fanfare or idealism or romance. This movie was resoundingly positively received. I remember seeing it and I saw it at Sydney Film Festival when it first premiered in Australia, and people were weeping and just completely moved and blown away about this exercise. If you've never heard anything, a single thing about Boyhood, in essence, it just follows the life of our lead character from the age of, I think it's five or six to roughly sort of 17, 18. It's a period of, in essence, 12 years. Richard Linklater took a troupe of actors and a series of locations, and simply in between the scheduling of the biggest stars of the movie being Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, who was Academy Award winner for her portrayal as the mother, pieced this document together about a young man's life and what it's like to grow up and the kind of tumultuous relationship going from a kid who is only obsessed with, you know, watching cartoons and the next Harry Potter release to romance and trying to find his way in the world. So an incredibly special film. Stars Ella Coltrane, who as Mason, who hasn't really gone on to do much, many massive things, but this feat on his resume is just absolutely stunning. As we said, Ethan Hawke, Patricia Arquette, Lorelei Linklater plays Samantha, the sister, so Richard Linklater's own daughter. Nice to cast your own daughter when you're shooting a movie over 12 years logistically. But it's a pretty magical movie, man. It had a huge response at the time. And I think without kind of constantly being back in the rotation, this is definitely a Linklater touchstone that many people revisit, despite the length. It's kind of a marvelous, unique thing.
It's my favorite Richard Linklater film.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. And part of that is, for me, it's, you know, it sounds, I don't know, pretentious to say this, but it's really his most like philosophical, dreamy movie, I think.
Yeah.
And I saw it at the perfect time, which is part of it. I saw Boyhood at release in 2014, and I was just finishing college at that time.
Yeah.
So here's this film all about massive life changes, how, you know, one era of your life tumbles into the next with all of these invisible, unannounced, simple cuts in time that could jump weeks, you know, months, decades. And I was at this point in my life where I was starting a new era and I was looking back at what I had done and all of that. And I had seen the movie with a lot of my childhood best friends. And we went through a lot of the different things the characters in the movie did. And I think for people of our generation, Blake, it does hold a unique resonance that I don't know if it will for future generations watching it. It'll almost become a time capsule for them. Because for us, I remember going to get Harry Potter books at release at midnight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like my childhood was all Blink-182, and there's a Blink needle drop in the movie. So, there's all these things that just make it almost personal where I feel like I'm in the movie. I feel like it's part of me and the other way around. It has this weird, like more real than real quality to it, where over the course of the film, by the end, it kind of feels like a life you lived as well.
Yes.
And to me, that is kind of the magic trick of Boyhood. And I didn't know how I would feel about it revisiting it now, and we'll get more into that later. But it, for me, it really held up. I just found it deeply emotional to revisit it once again.
Yeah, you're so right. It's like the songs that hit, it must be how boomers feel when they watch Forrest Gump. Like for them, that's like the soundtrack. But I'm like, low key, Boyhood, when you hear those tracks, it is like, oh, whoa, this is, and especially paired with the life that's in front of us. It's really special. And I hadn't watched this. I hadn't revisited it as much either. I think I watched it in the theater when I first saw it. I watched it originally on Blu-ray because I picked it up. I'm a physical media head. And then for many years, it sat on my shelf and I haven't revisited it. And it was excited to about this project. It's one of the most exciting things. It's like there are some films that are constantly in my rotation and others that aren't in there. And that's not necessarily a sign of quality either. It's just a reality, you know, like also you watching someone in their primary school play on an Apple Mac, you know, like the old, like with the colors and stuff. It's like, oh my God, that they were in my school. Like they were there, you know, those sorts of things. So you have this, there's a completely unique experience that you have of this movie going back at it specifically at our age, because I think I'm a whisker older than you, but much the same. There's that, that entire period is so deeply familiar, but watching this again, man, I think you touched on it. I think some of the reviews touched on it is the subtle, imperceptible time leaps and the way that Linklater constructs and stitches together these moments, or like articulates these moments of importance. And they're not, it's not like a traditional biopic or something like that where it's following these huge significant things. It's not like Four Weddings and a Funeral where there's like these huge events. Some of them are really micro, tiny. It's just going out and hanging with your mates in their house. It's camping out in their house. It's being built. It's going to a party. It's going to a music show. Like it's not there's not, you know, sometimes there's a prom adjacent, a graduation. But it's all these interesting and wonderful things, the way that it's pulled together. And yeah, I just, that's the thing that got me this time, is how you blink. And now with my own kids, how you blink and time is gone. It's just, it's so powerful and it's almost like an unfathomable feat to look at. Like it's incredible.
What really struck me this viewing is that it's obvious to say, but once you get older, time moves at a greater pace of acceleration, right? It's sort of entropic. It's always descending and getting faster and faster and faster. There's the snowball effect. And I hadn't seen Boyhood in many years. And what really stood out is that when the film cuts effortlessly from like one moment to the next, or from, you know, one new boyfriend suddenly becoming a husband to suddenly becoming divorced, all off camera, and we infer this just through the basic conversations of the characters, I discovered that that is what it is to be for me in my 30s. You know, I was at a party the other day with some of my friends, and one has a brand new baby. One is on his fourth, and you know, and it's like they were talking about how they're in preschool now, and I remember when they were born. And of course, I've seen him a lot over the years and everything, but you don't clock the time the same way. It becomes increasingly fragmentary just by virtue of the fact time is moving so fast. We don't have time to absorb each moment as much as we could when we were kids.
Yes,
it doesn't settle in and hit us as much. And that there's a line from Ethan Hawke's dad character in the movie at the end about that, how like you don't feel as much as you age, your skin gets a little bit thicker and everything like that. And man, it really was uncanny. And I found it very emotional very early on, as I just saw these life changes accruing and just so rapidly, and thinking that this is almost to me the greatest film to capture time in this way.
Yes.
When I say the film is almost the most philosophical movie he's made, I really mean it captures how ephemeral time is better than any movie I've ever seen.
Yes.
The transitions between periods of time, we've talked about how they're so invisible and unannounced and everything, but I think it's just Linklater is really precise in not bookending these moments with big events either.
Yes.
To your point, it's basic conversations, basic events. It's going to a ball game. with your dad. It's listening to your dad play guitar. It's going camping. It's built out of these small relatable moments more so really than the big milestones. And to me, that's what gives the film its real quality. It would be a lesser movie if it was, oh, here's Mason's first kiss. Here's his first dance. You know, here's the first time he had sex. Here's the first time he did this, this, this. There's a couple of little things like that, but that's mostly in the periphery. It's mostly just characters talking, and we learn about them through those conversations. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's haunting, especially because I know as someone who turns 33 soon, the time is just going to move faster. But it's the way Linklater captured that experience on film is amazing. And I know that now if I return to it in another 10 years, it's going to hit me in an even different way. And 10 years from then, in an even different way. And I think that also speaks to the power of the movie.
Yeah, there's so many great scenes now that, you know, when I was younger and I watched it 10 years ago, I was watching it through Mason's eyes. And I was like, wow, this happened. And stringing your own, like, imperceptible, like, I think it's, you know, things like social media and Instagram and stuff like that, they make you highlight everything, right? It's a curated expression of what your life, the sequence and the events of your life is. And, right. And narrative movies and television shows help, like, cause narratives help us understand what's happening. Life doesn't work that way. Like, people are complex, ambivalent, you know, contradictory people. Like, you know, you have these all these different poles of your personality depending on context, etc. And I think this movie captures something that is so spot on with that, which is that you, like, it's not, life happens in the periphery in the lead up to moments, not necessarily in the moments themselves. It's what, it's in the hangar of those moments, and this
and
time
those moments fly by so quickly when you're in them.
Oh my
right?
God. Yes. And they become definitive. And they become definitive.
Yeah, after. And the weird thing is that whenever I go on vacation, my girlfriend always makes fun of me for saying this, but I think it's true. I'm not going on vacations to be there. I'm going on vacations to remember it.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, that's
because
a funny thing.
When you're on vacation, time never moves faster.
Yes.
You know, it flies by. You're having so much fun. Your schedule is packed, whatever, you know, especially traveling abroad. You're always going all over the place and you're trying to squeeze all these things in. I take tons of pictures and videos and I revisit them and it puts me back in that place because when you're there, it just goes by so quickly. And it's in the lead up and in the retrospect that those moments have their meaning, I think, a lot of the time.
Yes.
But by that same token, Boyhood is weirdly a movie that's all about, and it ends with dialogue about this, about how the moment seizes you.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and how to be present as best you can in our limited capacity to be present. So the film, I think, really just captures all of those things really, really, really well. And to your point about contradictions, it's become a running joke in my group of friends whenever anything not too bad happens to one of us, but something annoying, one of us will say, hey, life doesn't give you bumpers. You know?
Yes.
The film, I think, is aware and conscientious of how difficult life can be within the confines of a pretty regular, average, somewhat privileged life. It captures how it feels hard at the time in a truthful way without making it seem like these characters are necessarily victims of great, you know, social tumultuousness or abuse, although there are abusers in the film.
Yeah.
There's just a lot going on in here, but he makes it feel so gentle as he takes us through these lives, you know?
And there's those points, and I think you're so spot on, as like Patricia Arquette got the sort of critical acclaim because of how she's navigating being a mother in this wild and wonderful situation, early mom reclaiming her own identity with education, going off and teaching, having a new family, that having a diabolical ending, you know, recreating the life anew. And it was so kind of, it's so, you appreciate it so much more when you get older, like watching Lorelai Linklater's Samantha, like going, we had to move. Like, I'm in dirty clothes. I don't know what to do. Like, because that's her whole life. Like, you have to, like, you're living your life from this very unique and anchored perspective where you are the center of the universe. And like these other little tiny things that seem inconsequential to the parents who are actually navigating the bigger things that are protecting you from those other things, the yawning gap between the adult in the room and the kid, it's, I love that the movie is kind of naked with that. Like, you know, Patricia Arquette has this amazing moment as Olivia where she's like breaking down as Mason's leaving. Like, Mason doesn't know what to do with it. And at the time, I remember I was probably too young to appreciate what that meant, but it was, Mason's never going to understand exactly what his mom is going through in that moment. And I think what's so kind of admirable about the way that Linklater did it was not to like make Mason some sort of sage, wise kid who can educate his mom in that moment and be illuminating and, you know, teach her with her own lessons back to her. It's just to kind of walk away because I don't live in the same world. Like, they do live in the same world, but they don't have the same experiences. So when mom breaks down, it's like, I'm going to go off and live my life. She's going to be sad in this moment, but we're going to get through it. And it's about like these moments where you just have to kind of walk past it. You kind of have to go acknowledge it. You have to be compassionate, but like there's certain things you can't fix because that's how they're feeling. And his mom has had a wild and crazy life. And I think so many people were so empathetic to her, to her terrific performance and how she navigated all those crazy situations to get to actually, you know, successful, kind children that everyone was like, oh my God, like she's really done heroic stuff here. And I love that. I love that about it. And it's also like, as much as a terrible shitbag as Ethan Hawke's character dad is earlier on in the film, him turning it around and, you know, starting a new life and being at a different place and coming to a different level of compassion and, you know, offering Olivia money, even though it's probably a small token of all the suffering that she's done, et cetera, to get where she's gotten to. I love the gaps because it's like, you can't understand what that adult parent has gone through to get you to be a good person. Cause there are so many sacrifices that are invisible to you that happened all throughout your life when it was imperceptible. But what's great about us as movie watchers is we've seen every tough thing that she's had to do to get to this moment.
Yeah. And I think you make a really important point about why Boyhood feels so special to me. There's not too much imposed narrative.
No.
On the film, there's not conventional character arcs. There's not too many moments where it rings with artifice. Like, you bring up that example of how he didn't give a wise lecture to his mom and turn her lessons back on her to be there for her the way that she could for him. He's clueless. He has no idea what.
No, he has no clue.
And the movie is full of moments like that that, again, feel very close to real life. For me, some of those are formal. Like, there's that one scene at the baseball game where the camera catches a home run.
Yes.
And then the same shot kind of whip pans to the family, to the actors reacting to the home run. And it's timed perfectly. If they missed that shot once, they're not getting it again. You know? But that scene to me was a metaphor for what the whole movie felt like it was doing the whole time. Even if that was kind of a spontaneous moment, a lot of the movie does feel that spontaneous and real. There's this one moment when at Mason's high school graduation party, one of the characters is like hugging him or giving a toast, and his best friend character, I never noticed this before, he's eating chips on a plate and some chips fall on the floor, like during this really important scene. I never noticed it before because your attention is of course towards the main cast. But even though that was an accident, they could have filmed that again, I guess, if they saw it. But to me, that's another example of how the movie's full of these little lifelike moments that add to the sense of realism of the thing. And I remember at the time, some people criticized the movie's dialogue as sometimes being a bit cringy, or like faux deep, like the characters are all trying to sound really complex and intellectual. But I don't know what childhoods these people had, but when I was 15 years old, I sounded like an idiot.
Yes.
And I was trying to be deep and I was trying to work through all the different emotions I was feeling and trying to carve out an independent identity and trying to seem edgy and cool in front of girls. And, you know, we don't sound cool. We
retroactively, we know how stupid we sound, and we want to crawl into a ball and evaporate into nothingness.
Yeah,
because you're like, oh my God, I was like, I did a brief stint in teaching, and I would sometimes hear the kids interacting with each other on a social level, you know, walking on a playground duty or whatever, which is in Australia means like during the time that kids are at lunch, you're walking around just to supervise to make sure no kids are getting up to any mischief, etc. And you hear the way that some of these guys talk to each other. And sometimes I'd often be in my own world, just sort of, you know, cruising past, and I'd hear someone say something and I'd just laugh. Like I just burst into laughter, and it was not what they said. It was me feeling a connection to someone having a completely boneheaded idea of something or a boneheaded perspective, and just going, oh yeah, like that's part of the process, is kind of like throwing these ideas about how the world works out there. And when you only have a chorus and a sounding board of your other dumb buddies, you guys think wrong about things, or you think very small, or they're very kind of quaint and naive ideas. And that's what this movie, I don't think it falls nearly into the traps of so many other movies, because it's just like it relishes in that. And also, he's a young kid who's growing up he's got a lot of different experiences. His mother is a psychologist. He obviously is articulate, and he has been so lucky and fortunate in a situation where he can be a little bit more artistic. And those kids, you know, he's reading Vonnegut at like 15. Like, he's going to be a kid who wants to be cool, edgy, beatnik. Like, we've all gone through those phases. A lot of us have had that lucky thing where you like want to get educated about stuff and rail against the man and whatever. And it's like, when you're 15, you're always an idiot. There's nothing cool about it. If you think it's cool, as you've been lied to from the day that Rebel Without a Cause was released, that teenagers are actually cool, because they're not. The movies that are the least cool are the most impactful and effective for me. And I think this movie's not about making him look like silly. It's trying to be really textured and authentic.
Trying to be real. Trying to be honest.
Trying to be honest. That's it.
Yeah. And I mean, dead on. And there's even that one scene where one of the students of Patricia Arquette's mother is in Mason's room looking at his tag. And you can see that, like, she is trying to look a little cool. Like, she's got a cool hat on. She's got a cool sweater on.
Plays a guitar.
You can kind of see. Yeah. And like, you could see the phases of different people expressing themselves in different ways and pushing the boundaries of what they want to look like and what their identity might be. And for me, this is really the good stuff in the film. Like, to me, this is really, you so rarely see this depicted on film in this way, where it's not trying too hard to make the characters look too stupid or too smart. They're sort of in the middle. And I really responded to that at the time, because I saw so much of myself in all of these characters. But I have to talk about Patricia Arquette's performance and speech, which you brought up, because she has this one line that, to me, this is in like my top five most devastating scenes I've ever experienced watching in a film. It's the exact scene where she breaks down to Mason, because she has this one line: I thought there would be more.
Yeah.
And man, shit, like that, even at that time, that hit me really hard, because there's this weird thing. Like, when you're in third and fourth grade, the eighth graders seem like they really have life figured out. And then when you get to that point, the high schoolers, wow, they have it all figured out for them. And then you go to high school, then you think about, oh no, the seniors. Then when you're a senior, it's college, right? Then when you're in college, no, it's the adults. There's this always kind of pushing back of when life will start to be full and make sense and unveil itself to you. And so to me, that connects young Mason trying to make sense of his world with the ultimate destination of where that journey will eventually lead. He can't understand it at that time. He might not understand it for decades. But it's that thing of how, you know, life is trying to fill yourself with things. It could be family, friends, loved ones. It could be your career. It could be your passions and your art, whatever. finding things to give meaning to your life, especially if you're sort of secular.
Yes.
And you don't have religion to do that, which also comes into the movie later on, I think, in a pretty humorous way. But
hilarious way.
It's so funny, yeah. And especially because, like, I was raised super religious. So to see that presence in the film the way that it does is very funny. But I also had a
flashback moment of, you know, when I was younger, raised Catholic in Australia because of my background. And I remember with my, like, our family stopping going to church. We moved away from, like, the immediate proximity of our family. Stopped going to church. It wasn't a habit. Like, we just did the big things, you know, confirmations and sort of things for those around. And then I remember, like, I would go down and stay with my grandmother, and there's, like, this ongoing lie of, like, yeah, we go to church. Like we go to church. And so the ongoing lie was like that. And then my grandmother would go to mass and I'd have to go with her.
Yes.
And I would just go with her and sit there. And I distinctly remember being like 12, 13, like not having been to church for years other than probably a wedding or perhaps a funeral, and sitting with my grandmother at just a sermon, like a packed house, you know, packed church with everyone there, a lot of, you know, ethnic folk, my little ethnic grandmother, and I'm sitting there holding her hand in mass. And I'm like, I was looking at Mason, I was laughing. I was just like, yeah, this happens, man. It happens. It's like people are doing things for their family, for their culture, for the continuity.
Present.
Yeah. The Bible present was great. And then the gun. Absolutely fantastic. The Bible and then the gun.
Yeah. Pure Texas, I think.
Oh,
all of that. But
Richard Linklater, you know, just winking lovingly at Texas, the place that he's called home for his entire life, and just going, you know, I know you. I know what Texas is, you know.
Yeah. But one thing I wanted to add with that one speech, and just Patricia Arquette's portrayal in general, and this is super personal. I've never talked about this on one of your podcasts. You know it about me personally.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2016, I lost my mom. And very suddenly, like one day she was there, one day she wasn't sick, it was just an accident. And watching this performance, I don't know if I've ever seen a mom seem so real as a mom before in any other movie.
Yes.
So seeing this character be a mom all the way through in this way, it pulverized me emotionally throughout. And to me, that's personal to me. But on the other hand, I think it speaks to the reality they're able to conjure. The way she knows how to be stern and loving, you know, the way she has like a limit of patience, and they don't impose that thing of how, like, usually when a parent will snap at their kids, there's another scene right after of them like, I'm so sorry I raised my voice. Like, you know, to caution the audience, this is not okay. Boyhood doesn't really do that. It just shows people being human in the moment, and then it moves on to the next moment. And, you know, my mother had like unending love. I'm an only child. She was like a mom's mom and everything. And because of that, seeing this, you know, mother character love her children so much while still being a person herself, and the kids increasingly discovering that their mom is also a person and they can engage with her. Like, I really love those moments where I really responded to this as like an emotional, fraught emo kid in his teens, when he has the earrings and the nail polish and the male of the household is calling Mason out. And you can see on her face that she wants to protect him.
Yes.
She might not like the nail polish. She might not like those things necessarily, but she wants to protect the identity of her son and, you know, cherish that. And man, that stuff hits me so hard. And there's that scene where he comes back, you know, a little crossfaded.
Yeah.
And she's just like, okay, like, we'll talk about this later. And everybody knows me, knows, like, I don't drink, I don't smoke. I'm like a straight edge emo kid teetotaler. But I would be out with my friends super late or whatever. And I'd come home, it'd be a similar situation where she'd be like, you were out late, huh? And I'd be like, yeah. She's like, were there any girls there? Maybe. Okay. Like, we'll talk about this tomorrow. You know, and that stuff is really hitting me in a different way now. But again, it just really, I think, points to what the movie does differently than so many other films and what the film was wise enough to do it the way that it did, you know?
Yes. It's so that segues. So we've talked very much about how it's aged and our preliminary and current responses, but I just want to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and I want to talk about what we've learned on this movie, because I feel like there are so many lessons of Boyhood that have been influenced a whole peer group of filmmakers, even if they haven't influenced viewers in an enduring way. I think filmmakers really, so I want to touch on that with you. So let's talk about that.
¿Qué tal, mi gente? Te saluda Emanuel González de Mark Wahlberg Auto Group. Somos la agencia más grande de Chevrolet y GMC de todo Columbus, donde encuentras los carros y camionetas nuevos, cero millas al mejor precio. También contamos con más de 800 carros usados de todas las marcas en inventario. Te podemos aprobar con número ITIN y aceptamos identificación o pasaporte de tu país. En Mark Wahlberg te esperamos con los brazos abiertos. Visítanos hoy mismo, 3900 West Broad Street, al oeste de la ciudad, a un lado del casino. Te atendemos completamente en español. Márcanos ya, 833-699-0792.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's come back. I remember distinctly, and you know, you working at Next Best is a perfect reminder of this. Of like, this is the silly season at the time we're recording this. It's the awards season. Things are ramping up. Oscar nominations are out. People are deliberating and prognosticating, and punting as well on who's going to win. And I remember distinctly, it was like Chris Nolan, could have been Mike Lee. Richard Linklater at like a director's roundtable together talking about Boyhood. And so I love those director's roundtables, the peer groups that they sometimes get together for those things, because they're just so wonderful watching the filmmakers as peers talk to each other. And I remember distinctly like Nolan and a couple of the guys, they're talking to Linklater just about the actual feat of what he had done, like the scale of what he had done, like the complexity of like, what happens if someone passes away during this? Like, how do you recast? What would you have done? You know, people asking, you know, well, I would have written them out of the movie because life happens, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But I just distinctly remember his peer group at the time, being in awe of the feat of what he had achieved. And I think maybe it's easy because Linklater as a filmmaker has been so eclectic and diverse and so on the fringes to like, you know, his most watched movies, probably like his most watched movie ever is like School of Rock. Like that's I would have said Dazed and Confused every day of the week, but like School of Rock seems to be the one that's like every single human in the world has watched. And especially as my time as a teacher, I can tell you for sure, like that's a perfect project to put on for a group of kids. If you've got a rain day or you've run out of work or it's like the last day before school holidays or something like that. So, but he's so eclectic. He's got like a small patch of movies that he's made. And I just think that Boyhood, like other than the Before trilogy, which also ruminates on time and experience and life, also starring Ethan Hawke, I just think that the lesson of this is like, I don't think that anyone is as bold to have ever made a project to make a project like this or to make a project like it again. I don't think it could ever happen again, Brendan. I don't know if there's something like this that could exist again on this scale, other than someone that is in its shadow directly.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, theoretically, if anybody could, it would be Richard Linklater. And
yeah.
I think he's attempting some new version of this idea, like some longitudinal project. I forget what it is. We could Google it right now.
Yeah.
I think he's adapting some play or some book over a huge period of time, but it's not going to be what Boyhood was. And I think the hat trick with Boyhood at the time, speaking of award season, is how it came out of nowhere, right?
Yes, yes.
No one knew it was happening. And as you say, he's on the fringes making the movie. But what really stood out to me this viewing too is that, like, it doesn't look cheaply produced. Like, there's camera cranes in it for establishing shots that give it a sense of scale. It's perfectly conceived of what moments to go, like, bigger budget, get the cinematic toys out, etc. And I wonder, though, if theoretically stuff like this might be more possible now, if only because, like, the budget for this was pretty robust, but now you theoretically could use any camera.
Yes.
To do it. But I think that the majesty of the film, the magic of it, isn't necessarily the insane logistics of how it was made. It is how Linklater organized and arranged it in a way where when you're watching it, like Kermode's quote, you do stop thinking about the behind the scenes
craziness. Yeah.
Yeah. There's this one scene in the movie we haven't talked about that's one of my favorite scenes in any film, I think. When Mason is asking, like, if there's elves.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And Ethan Hawke, in a very Ethan Hawke-y speech, talks about, like, well, why do you think elves are more magical than something like whales? Right.
Yeah.
You know, a very James Cameron, the way of water coded speech now in 2024. But I think that moment, like, about the magic in the world with whales, that could also be applied to the film Boyhood itself because of where it came from, right? Like, the fact that we as human beings are able to arrange all of this the way that it did is, to your point, kind of unrepeatable.
Yes.
To me, that is a feat as special as whales singing at the bottom of the ocean, that we can create an object that shows our experience through time back to us.
Yes.
So what I really take away revisiting it is just how 10 years on, how utterly unique it is. You know, and you talk about influence. I don't know if any of these filmmakers cite Boyhood, but there's been so many, like, memory pieces and, like, movies dealing with time and the ephemeral nature of time to come out since Boyhood, some directed by Christopher Nolan. But like, just today, he said that Nolan's two favorite recent films were After Sun and Past Lives, which I think are to some extent in conversation with something like Boyhood, which plays
Definitely.
With time and memory and how these things, how our very nature of existence can feel somehow metaphysical at the same time.
Yes. And I was going to say Past Lives was one this year that was, if I hadn't already locked down my list, would probably have made it into my top 10. It was a really special movie. And yeah. I think that's the closest sort of allegory. But what's so funny since then is that, like, Ethan Hawke, kind of poet laureate for cinema and acting, has sort of happened between now and then. Linklater still is on the fringes. He makes these movies. We don't actually know what he's doing unless you start researching. What is he up to? Like, he's not like gone off and made a superhero movie. He's making Richard Linklater movies, small, large, whatever he wants.
He doesn't live in LA. He's off the radar.
He's off the radar. He makes these huge movies. Oh, sorry. Small movies that have a huge rewatch and cult-ish following beyond the life of the movies, especially with the Before trilogy, like canonized. We spoke about Before Midnight is released the year before. So if you're listening to the Decade Projects, you know, I covered that with Gavin Mevious from the Mixed Reviews podcast. But what's so funny is the emergence of Maya Hawke since then, that as a singer and as an actor, and the I don't know how much to be trusted on the old IMDb trivia, but the Black Album is one of my favorite scenes in this movie, where Ethan Hawke's dad is giving Mason a Beatles album that he has compiled of all the songs and tracks that they made as individuals that they couldn't make together. And he's saying they were the best rock band ever because of the way they harmonized and et cetera. And he gave his fictional son Mason that on his 15th birthday, but he also compiled that album and gave it to Maya after he'd broken up with Uma Thurman. And so I love the way that Richard Linklater and Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy too, and obviously Patricia Arquette, they worked the events of their lives into these characters in such an inextricable way that it's just like, it then cuts even deeper to the resonances of like this verite quality of like you're watching life unfold. It's so imperceptible. It's so subtle. It happens. But then there's this deepness, like you said, like it's such an Ethan Hawke-y speech, knowing more of the personality of Ethan Hawke later, that it's like, oh, like, I don't know where the reality begins and ends. You know, I don't know where it is, because it's like, also you're literally watching someone bring their current self to that moment, to that exercise for X amount of minutes, and then bang them on to the next thing. And it's like, the imposition of those things is so funny. That's one of my favorite little bits of trivia, is that, you know, they were bringing so much of their lives, their, you know, divorces, their new children, their new outlooks, to the way that they crafted their characters as the adults. And then the kids were kind of growing and being around first. So yeah, it's really crazy. Really crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously the Before trilogy does that a good amount too, where like Ethan Hawke and, you know, Julie Delpy, they're playing like versions of themselves.
Yes.
And I've looked into how Boyhood was made quite a bit, and like how much was scripted, how much wasn't, how much was made up on the spot, if anything. And I think that the intersection of real life and fiction is what helps give the film its texture. Like, so for example, a lot of the needle drops seem so perfect. Like Gautier shows up, when they're visiting university to check it out. And when Richard Linklater was making the movie or potentially scripted those scenes, he had no idea potentially like what the top song would be at that time. He'd have to find the perfect song to capture that moment in history, right?
Yes.
So we even see this with the needle drops, where they feel so organically woven into the movie that it's one of those things where part of the discipline and project for Boyhood was allowing life to change the document they were making.
Yes.
And that, again, is just super unusual and strange. Obviously, like, there's movies that use improvisation, but not necessarily on such a sweeping level across like all levels of what the film is doing, you know?
It's so funny to wonder, like, because music has been so important to Linklater, like, obviously Dazed and Confused has one of the best and most expensive, I think, in history soundtracks to ever put together for a single movie, which is why it still maintains its greatness. I think the soundtrack cost more than the movie production, I believe, is the history of the Dazed and Confused movie. But yeah, it's really fascinating to me that he like was so on point, is because when you think about this movie starting broadly in kind of you know, 2002, 2003, like I remember being in 2003 driving to university and listening to Coldplay. And so even the way the movie sounds, I was just like, oh my God, like I was listening to Coldplay in my car, like going to my equivalent of college at that time. And I was just like, even that, it might seem like cringe or whatever, but it's just like, oh, it's so perfect that like, it's right. Like there's a cultural cringe that happens in Australia. I'm not sure if you've heard that phrase before, but Australians sometimes don't like it, seem to like rail against Australian stories being told, or like sort of nakedly kind of like authentic Australian portrayals, because it's cultural cringe. Like, we're embarrassed that that's actually who we are, and people butt up against it and say, that's not who we are. Whereas I would say, no, that's exactly who we are. If you feel uncomfortable, sometimes it's familiar and it's embarrassment, and it's like you're being exposed because this is something that feels so spot on. And I think that that's what's great about Boyhood, is that it does have that level of exposure where you feel exposed, and as you're watching it, because it feels so right if you're from a certain, you know, walk of life. But it seems to work. It seems to get over that exposure and has this immersion where it doesn't reject you. You're not watching it. You're never watching Boyhood as like, as you said, an exercise in filming something over 12 years, 10 to 15 minutes roughly every year that they got back together. You're going, this is an amazing document of someone's life, and I'm in it. And I'm complete, like literally from the first move, they walk out of the house, and Lorelai Linklater is like, you know, goodbye house, goodbye things mum couldn't say, we couldn't take. And she's like, cut the attitude, whatever. So yeah, it's really, I love that it is able to penetrate that all these years later.
Yeah. And again, there's, even with like these other movies we're talking about, Past Lives or After Sun, which I think are wonderful films, both ranked on my top 10 of their years. What really hits me with Boyhood, in addition to everything else we've already said, are these little moments that, in retrospect, like even today, I rewatched Boyhood yesterday, and today I've been busy at work. And even in like the brief moments where I was like thinking about the movie, preparing for the podcast, there's a certain like faculty of a certain genre of film, especially like surreal film, but not always, where the movies start almost playing back to you as your memory.
Yes.
Not as a motion picture. You know, I think David Lynch is famously one of the best examples of that. Like they needle into your subconscious in a really uncanny way. Boyhood does that for me in the opposite direction, where instead of me feeling like it was something I had dreamt, it feels like a memory someone had like implanted into me, like I'm in Blade Runner. Like it feels like, yeah, like it feels like when, like you bring up that moment when, you know, the daughter's going to the car and Patricia Arquette's like, cut out that horseshit attitude, whatever. Like those moments feel so palpable, they almost feel like they happened to me.
Yes.
And because of course many of them did.
Yeah.
I lived through a large percentage of what the characters go through in this movie. Like my parents stayed together their, you know, entire marriage. They didn't get divorced. There was luckily no string of abusive ex-husbands. But of course, I had friends who lived through that, and yes, they would be at my house crying their eyes out about it, or on the phone with me at 3 a.m. crying their eyes out about it. And so in that capacity, you live through that through osmosis, right?
Yes.
And I hadn't lived through it at the time I saw it the first time, but the moment where Mason and his girlfriend at the time get walked in the morning because they didn't think someone would be there, that has happened to me since I saw Boyhood for the first time, when I was staying over at a friend's place, and they're like, oh yeah, you could use the guest bedroom, no big deal, to stay over. And well, they came back early, you know. And that happened to me like 6 months after I saw the movie. But The thing about it is
that happened to me. That happened to me at my brother's house with a high school girlfriend.
there you go. This happened to me when I was in my 20s. Yeah. But no, the thing about it is, so many of these moments find this perfect balance between feeling familiar and true without becoming cliches.
Yes.
I have no idea how he pulled off that perfect balance. But to me, I think a lot of it is how naturalistic the performances are, of course, how naturalistic the acting can like express the quote unquote cringy dialogue.
Yeah.
But also how like his visual style, and of course he's famous for this for the Before trilogy, is so spare.
Yes.
There's like a quiet elegance to his frames. He's not trying to make a movie for the one perfect shot Twitter account. But what is being framed and how it's framed is also always perfect.
Yes.
You know, it's not the flashiest looking movie, but it's exactly how this movie needs to look.
Yeah, it's the aesthetic matches, and it's even like the only major sliding doors moment that I can track in the research that I did here, because it doesn't ever seem like it was ever going to be anyone else but Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, is that like Linklater had said, I don't know whether it was jokingly during the press tours, but I've got a couple of sources on it now, is like, if he died halfway through the movie, that Ethan Hawke would direct the rest of the movie. Like, that's the only like sliding doors kind of thing. And I think that would be strange in and of itself to watch a director like directorial style, like take over or change, you know, halfway through. But Linklater has always been this guy who innately knows how to imperceptibly put the camera at just the right, you know, I think in fighting, they call it like, you know, your range, you know, to keep out of trouble. And I think that his way is to just get you into this weird middle ground range. It's kind of like reminiscent of some sort of classic sort of John Fordian shots, almost like where you can see the depth of field in the frame and it doesn't ever really feel claustrophobic. You get to orient yourself in whatever space that you're in, but he just has this uncanny ability to know what range to keep the camera. He just is so good at saying, I'm going to keep it right here. And like when he does push in, it becomes something. And then other times it's just these beautiful 35 millimeter glorious shots of just all around Texas, you know, the entire Texas landscape and towns and back alleyways and all those sorts of things. And it's just, yeah, I think there's just something. He's just got such a unique style, and it's not flash. It's really special. And this movie,
he withholds close-ups.
Yes.
Yeah. He withholds his close-ups for really key moments, like speaking about the range. But as I said earlier, he also is really, really smart about when to deploy the showier shots. Like there's when Mason goes off to college, ultimately, there's that shot that must have been filmed on some kind of rig on like a truck, because it's slightly above the focal point of where you would be like in a car. It's like looking down.
Yeah, looking down.
It's a downward angle. And it captures this beautiful Western Texas scenery, and it perfectly times what it means to, you know, be a young person entering a new seemingly epic insurmountable environment for yourself. And notably, on some of his other trips, Linklater's really careful about when to show scale.
Yes,
he often will show scale through a little bit of crowd work or through supporting characters to make the world of Mason's life feel a little bit bigger socially. You know, he's just so deliberate. And that's why I think that he should have won Best Director for this. No question to me at all, because it's such a masterclass of knowing what moment needed precisely which shot. And he kept that going the entire duration of filming these people's lives over years.
It's so criminal, because it's like the directing and particularly the editing is so incredible, and the degree of difficulty with which he had to execute to make both of those things work so seamlessly in the story. It just feels like this is a movie that no one would have been mad at winning Best Director and Best Editing. Like no one would have been on the inverse of like a, you know, JFK, you know, Oliver Stone and being Best Director and then like having Best Editing. It's like, yeah, that makes sense. Like it makes a lot of sense. Like the movie is whatever you think about the movie in 2024, which I deeply love. But whatever you think about it, it's like, it's one of the most phenomenally directed things you've ever seen, and a really flashy and aggressive and multi-camera stock and hyper stylized editing, black and white color, you know, rich tweaks to lighting and things like that to give different feelings. And the editing is just spellbinding, because how do you wrangle all that together? But on the inverse, it's like such a delicate, elegant,
brush that's been painted in this logistically crazy exercise, and then these imperceptible motions through time. It's like, that's a feat. That's something that needs to be studied, I feel like. And even if it maybe isn't a movie that, you know, at nearly 3 hours running time, that's, you know, constantly in rotation, man, is it rewarding to go back to from a technical perspective as well as a deeply emotional perspective.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually think it's going to age really, really well. I think if anything, the film's reputation soured in the immediate years after release a little bit. But I think in the long run, perhaps as people like return to it, they're going to see how truthful it was to the time in which it was made.
Yes.
And I think those films tend to age really well because we want to go back to them to re-experience and relive those moments in time. It's such a document that captures like perfectly so many of these little episodes. Like we've already talked about the Harry Potter and the Blink-182 and, you know, all those things are so specific. And perhaps, you know, they'll lose resonance in the short term, but I think in the long term, people will go back and rediscover what this could be. I mean, there's so many wonderful movies in the 70s, like the new Hollywood era, that do that. And it was not in existence in the 70s.
Yes.
But I can feel a taste of the culture and that way of life by revisiting some of those key films at that time. You know, The Graduate would be an obvious example, you know, and you get a taste of what that period of time was like. For me, Boyhood's going to do that in the long run.
Big time. Brendan, it is always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. This movie is really special. I'm so glad that you chose it. I think we might have one more decade project that we're going to talk about. So I'll just tease that, but I won't tell people what it is, which is completely different to Boyhood, by the way. But can you do some plugs so that people know where to find you and all of the great stuff that you've got going on with Next Best and the great stuff that you're working on for Brightwall?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me on twitter.com at Metaplex Movies, or to make it easier on you, to search Brendan Hodges. I'm basically the only one. Same thing goes for Letterboxd. I am also a writer and podcaster at Next Best Picture. And I write sometimes for other publications like Polygon, Inverse, and Brightwall Darkroom.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to Decade Project 2014. We will catch you on many more episodes scouring the year, talking about some of the films that came out that year, maybe even talking about the films where there were the best directors and the best editors. But for mine, probably... Not gonna come quite close to Boyhood for me. I think as far as technically a brilliant movie, but it's been a pleasure talking to you, my friend. Always great to chat, and we'll catch you another time on Decade Project soon.
Yeah, so happy to be here, man. It was a lot of fun.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.